Good morning and welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. President Obama is in Europe this week for the G8 summit in Ireland. His reception by Europeans is a little frostier than it's been in past years, in part because of the controversy emerging at home over surveillance and scrutiny of phone and internet records by the National Security Agency, measures that some European leaders had been critical of in past U.S. presidential administrations. But if the reaction among Europeans has been strong, it pales in comparison to the controversy that has brewed in this country since the U.K. newspaper The Guardian first published its report on the government's access to cell phone records, and NSA contractor Edward Snowden came forward as a source of leaks. Some members of Congress have complained that they've been left in the dark about surveillance and national security issues, while the Obama administration and other members of Congress have defended the programs, saying they're needed to help keep the country safe. But Lake Effect contributor Art Sear believes it's worth looking at how the NSA has conducted past surveillance programs. Sear, who directs the A.W. Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College, tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke there's not much to distinguish what the NSA is doing today versus what it's always done.
I actually don't think it is that much different. It comes in the wake of 9/11 and the comprehensive inconvenience we all suffer, especially but not just at the airport, as a result of the very explicit terrorist threat, but there is nothing new about the federal government engaging in surveillance of American citizens.
Well, so what do you make of the reaction to the disclosure that the government's been collecting things like cell phone records and doing internet surveillance of Americans on a wide scale? Why is there this hue and cry now?
Because Americans don't care for authority and because it's much more public than it used to be. Congress is much more active, which creates problems in terms of leaks of information and the fact that it's almost impossible for most members of the House and Senate to actually keep secrets when revealing something might be helpful to their election. Nonetheless, we have much more public surveillance, if you will, of the government today than in the past. And especially since 2008, the Congress has been very active and I think overall responsible, despite what I just said, in interacting with and learning about what the government is doing.
Is there a difference, though, in how much easier it might be for the NSA to do its job? I mean, people are connecting with each other in ways that they did not used to be able to connect to each other. Does that in some ways make the collection of data about people easier?
Yes, I think it's a matter of technology. I'm not at all sure that human interaction, and certainly human nature hasn't been changed. Human interaction has been changed, but thanks to extremely sophisticated algorithms, pervasive information collection, we really don't have any privacy. And I say that with emphasis. We don't have privacy in the way that we used to. At the same time, we still have relative anonymity because there's such a vast amount of data being automatically, through automation, collected that it's in some ways, as difficult as it always has been to collect information about specific individuals in a really focused way.
The message we hear from the Obama administration, in addition to the point that they are not the first administration to do this kind of surveillance, is that there is no sense of national security without these kinds of measures. Do they have a point?
I think they do. The president so far has not – if they are misleading Congress, especially given other imbroglios related to Benghazi and that sort of thing, the president could be in some serious political trouble. But so far, I think he's acquitted himself persuasively and effectively. The government during the Vietnam period engaged in extensive, much more human and personal surveillance of people. I served in the U.S. Army reserves and on active duty, although mostly in the reserves during the 60s and early 70s. And my branch happened to be military intelligence. During that period, the U.S. Army, as well as the CIA and the FBI, engaged in extensive and very focused surveillance and information collecting on individual Americans. In many ways, that was more insidious than what's going on today.
Some of the complaints have been over the secrecy under which this has been carried out and the kind of rubber stamping the surveillance requests get from the court that oversees this. Is there a question we ought to be asking about oversight, like you know, who keeps an eye on the people that are keeping an eye on us?
You're referring to the FISA courts,
right,
established in direct reaction a few years ago to the felt need for the rule of law to have oversight in this activity. I disagree with the characterization of rubber stamp. There are 11 federal judges. Federal judges are scrutinized through the appointment process. As we all know, because of political conflict, they tend to be very serious, very effective, and dedicated professionals. The rotating judges, I think, helps undercut dangers of an old boy network or too much familiarity with the intelligence people you're dealing with. I think it's been handled pretty professionally. I don't minimize the potential for danger, and also I can't say emphatically enough that you don't have you don't have privacy today in the way that you used to. I'm constantly amazed at how people, not just college students, but others, including people in sensitive jobs in Washington, will communicate by email and put the most inflammatory and casual and embarrassing things down in email. That is public information for all practical purposes. Since the 1960s, we mentioned military intelligence. We've been talking about the NSA. Since the 1960s, any telephone conversation is subject to government monitoring. That's been going on for a half a century if they want to do it. You don't have privacy, and don't assume that you do.
Should we be asking ourselves questions?
I think it's a very healthy debate, and I'm sure it'll go on for a while, and I think that's a very good thing to do. I think what's acceptable and what's unacceptable behavior in the intelligence realm should be debated all the time. One thing that's not being discussed much is the fact that the most recent notorious leaks were done not by civil servants, military people, government career professionals, but by a contractor for Booz Allen and Hamilton. The growth of military and intelligence contractors using corporations for gathering and analyzing information, a trend that really exploded with the first Gulf War, I think is particularly insidious and should be discussed in a way that it isn't so far, as far as I know.
It's interesting in the privacy discussion. There seem to be a lot of people very upset that the government is able to do this. And at the same time, if you spend any time online, Google and Facebook and any number of other corporations are doing similar kinds of data mining, and we don't seem nearly as upset about that. Is there anything practically different, or is it really saying something about Americans and our attitudes towards the government versus our attitudes towards the business world?
I think that's a very good point, and basically I agree with you. It's something I think about a lot. I think we're suspicious of both public and private authority. The state is different. The state can take your life legally. The state can destroy your life in a way that private corporations cannot, and certainly not as easily. Apple had brilliant marketing leadership under Steve Jobs, but just before his life especially, he was emphatic in articulating very persuasively and clearly his corporation's commitment to protecting the privacy of their consumers. It's a debate that goes on. I think Apple sets the standard for corporations. Microsoft hasn't done nearly as well. Google is doing better. But you're quite right about what's available in the private sector. Our college is extremely strong in GIS, Geographic Information Systems. Reflecting the fact that the University of Wisconsin is very strong in geography. There is a billion-dollar private corporation, ESRI, that has, so far at least, a lock on GIS technology. We've raised money at our Clausen Center, and our students especially and faculty have carried out research for government and business using GIS technology. I don't even need your address, just your census tract, your zip code. If I know roughly where Mitch Tyke lives, it's almost frightening the degree of information we can collect about your likely educational background, ethnic, racial background, how you spend your money, again, to a frightening degree. And it's important very much to keep in mind that we are being tracked passively all the time.
Well, and so I wonder if, to get back to the first question about what's different about this, is part of this the intersection between what the government is collecting and what corporations are collecting, and
yes,
whether the government has access to what the corporations are already doing?
Yeah, that's right. I think that's one thing that makes private contracting insidious. It's also a sign of laziness on our part as citizens, laziness and complacency that we're willing to contract out to a corporation guns for hire, military activity, as well as supply and intelligence and other activities. MPRI, Military Professional Resources, Inc., is not nearly as notorious as the former Blackwater. But they have worked not only for the Pentagon, but they have worked for governments which are on our State Department list as terrorist states. There are literally guns for hire. And there's very little that's been published on the subject.
Let's move to a slightly different topic here. President Obama is in Europe for the G8 summit this week, where he is being met by a fair amount of criticism over how long it took for the United States to support the rebels in Syria. Why did it take so long?
I think President Obama is extremely reluctant to use force overseas, and that's something I applaud, the judiciousness compared to the recklessness, especially of someone like John McCain, his opponent in the election of 2008, someone I admire a lot personally. And I supported McCain, in fact, very directly supported the campaign in 2000. But he's much too reckless, especially in old age, and interventionist. I think the judiciousness that President Obama, given the extraordinary military power we command, dwarfing any single European country, and for that matter, even the rest of NATO together, is to be applauded. The Europeans are also more directly involved in resources questions. That's why they took the lead, which worked out okay, in Libya. They're far more dependent on Middle Eastern oil than we are. And frankly, there is a residual sentiment of anti-Semitism in Europe that is far stronger in this country, in my belief.
There's more anti-Semitism in this country?
No, there's less. There's less. Which is why we're much more strongly and consistently committed to Israel and generally more reluctant to intervene in the Middle East on behalf of the Arab states. There's far less anti-Semitism in this country than there was until and after World War II. I think the fading of that, along with obvious racism, is huge progress in the U.S.
Well, and so how is the U.S. involvement now likely to affect the direction of the Syrian conflict?
I think it automatically puts an emphasis on working together, and it will be harder for any single European country to go it alone. The umbrella of NATO automatically becomes stronger. Hezbollah is now very active in the Syrian rebel effort. Thanks to the efforts of Israel, I'm quite willing to criticize their foreign policy. We now have Hamas and Hezbollah, which used to be enemies, working together thanks to the hardline foreign policy of the Netanyahu government. Hezbollah fought the Israeli military to a standstill in Lebanon, the first time that has happened. This civil war is extraordinarily intense and bloody. If we intervene on the ground directly, which I think would be a huge mistake in a public manner, I think it's a recipe for expanding an already very bloody war. We also rather arrogantly, and here Americans, I think, despite Vietnam, we tend to be more casual than Europeans about assuming that we can automatically intervene and therefore change the nature of what's going on in the country. There is a kind of arrogance that's associated with our great power that I think is part of the explanation for our strategic blunder in invading Iraq.
And finally, back in January, you made the case on this show that that Turkey was going to be a big story this year in some way, and that is proving to be the case. What do you see the unrest in Turkey representative of, in your estimation?
Well, thank you for mentioning one of the occasions I turned out to be right and not other occasions where I clearly was wrong. There is a sharp division between the Islamic population that is religiously committed and the rest in Turkey, even though it's 98-99% Islamic technically. It's also a very secular constitution, country, and society. The religious party that is currently in power has highlighted that basic split between the secularists and the others. Prime Minister Erdogan has so far stopped short of sparking a really violent crisis, especially with the army. However, he's kind of playing a Putin game. He wants the office of president of the country, which has been largely ceremonial, to get some real power. And then I understand his plan is to move from being prime minister to being president. I think this obvious abuse of authority, more than anything else, in his increasingly autocratic, imperious ways, a danger for any chief executive, is the principal reason why there's this problem.
Art Sear, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch. Always a pleasure.
Art Sear teaches political economy and world business and is the director of the A.W. Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He's our regular foreign policy contributor, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich. Coming up next, we'll talk with author Kate Atkinson about her newest book, Life After Life. Stay tuned. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.